and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, spies who went into the cold. Speaker Bob Wallace worked for the Central Intelligence Agency for 32 years. He served as the CIA's Director of Office of Technical Service. This talk was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded on Friday, September 5th, at the Hotel Captain Cook. Wallace was the keynote speaker at the 2014 Alaska Cold War Conference that took place over the weekend in Anchorage. He's introduced by Lisa Falsko, president of the Alaska World Affairs Council.
Mr. Bob Wallace is the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency Office of Technical Service. Between 1995 and 2002, Mr. Wallace served as deputy director and director of the CIA's Office of Technical Service and directed the office's global response to the 9/11 terrorist attack in the United States. As a senior CIA executive combined with 18 years of field experience, Wallace has been honored for working effectively with decision makers in the intelligence community, private sectors, and Congress. And he told me that it's a secret, but he apparently invented the internet. So you need to ask him about that. Following retirement in 2003, Wallace founded Artemis Consulting Group, a network of intelligence professionals providing management counsel, strategic planning, and representational services to government and corporate clients. Wallace's CIA awards include the Intelligence Medal of Merit, the Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal, and two Donovan Awards. In 2005, he received the Ottawa University Alumni Association Outstanding Achievement Award. Wallace speaks and writes on intelligence, leadership, and management topics throughout the United States, including the book Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA's Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda. And he has some copies and is going to be here signing those books. So if you don't have one yet, right after this program, you can go out to the desk, pick up one of our brochures and his book, and he'll sign it for you. Bob Wallace is here today to speak about spies who went into the cold. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Bob Wallace.
So these microphones are always too short, always too tall for me when I stand up. Yeah. Thank you for that kind introduction. I have had the opportunity to visit Alaska many times during my career as a CIA officer. My first visit was actually as an Army E-3, stopping here in January of 1969 on my way to Tonsonook in Vietnam. So just a terrific opportunity, and I'm grateful to the World Affairs Council and to the Alaskan Historical Society for the invitation to talk to you today. It was about 150 years. It'll be 150 years ago next spring when Alaska's future was partially determined by a failed intelligence operation. The Tsar at the time was blissfully unaware that thousands of miles distant from his territory in North America, a ring of spies were plotting to alter the course of history. An unemployed actor had gathered intelligence about the President of the United States movements, and with a band of co-conspirators, he sought to decapitate the 80-year-old American government. The objective was to reverse the outcome of the Civil War by assassination of President Lincoln, Vice President Andrew Johnson, and perhaps equally importantly, Secretary of State William Seward. On April 15, 1865, Booth shot President Lincoln in Ford's Theater. But just a mile away, Lewis Powell, another conspirator, broke into the house of William Seward and found the ailing Secretary of State in his bedroom. He stabbed him several times in the face and the neck and assumed that his deed was done. Unfortunately for Powell, outside the house, his colleague David Harold, who was minding the two getaway horses, heard screams from inside, panicked and fled, taking both of the horses with him. That forced Powell. Now, this is how intelligence operations really work, okay? That forced Powell to improvise and escape on foot, but being unfamiliar with Washington, he was arrested the next day. Miraculously, Seward survived. 2 years later, he made the widely ridiculed purchase of Alaska. Many mocked the president as well as Seward, calling Alaska Johnson's polar bear garden. Seward himself acknowledged that the value of his purchasing Alaska would not be recognized as useful for at least a generation. In fact, almost a century passed before Alaska's significance to our national security would be realized. During World War II, before CIA was created, an Army intelligence officer named Colonel Lawrence Kastner organized Kastner's Cutthroats. This was the unofficial name for the 1st Alaskan Combat Platoon, or is otherwise known as the Alaskan Scouts. The Alaskan Scouts conducted intelligence and reconnaissance operations in the occupied Western Aleutians, identified landing zones for amphibious assaults on the Japanese, and provided communications and guide services to Army units. Now, about the same time, the American government began supplying fighter airplanes to the Soviet Union through the Alaskan-Siberian transport route. Soviet engineers and pilots lived in Alaska. They certified and ferried the planes that were to be delivered across a multi-hops across Siberia to the German front. Now, almost all of the Soviets spoke no English, so a native Russian speaker, an intelligence officer named Captain George Kieswalter, transferred from an assignment at Dutch Harbor to the aircraft program. Kieswalter had an engaging personality, and combined with his natural ease in Russian-English translations, he ingratiated himself with the Soviets. Because Russia was not at war with Japan, the Soviet pilots could fly these planes safely through or across the Japanese-occupied airspace because the planes displayed large visible red stars of the Soviet Union. However, in the course of the delivery, the Soviets ran out of the Red Star decals. So what to do? The Soviet pilots at the time would be understandably concerned about flying American planes, unmarked American planes, through Japanese territory. So at that point, George Kieswalter recalled that there was a Texaco operation in Fairbanks. George Kieswalter went to Fairbanks and bought every Texaco Star decal that he could get his hands on. Next slide, please. He told the Russians, "Now see, this is a big red star just like yours. It's a Texaco Star, admittedly, but it can be seen even better than your Red Star. You won't be disloyal now by flying these planes with a Texaco Star across the straits or across the territory, and the Japanese won't be wise enough to know the difference between a Red Star and a White Star, and they'll think it's just one of the things you're doing." So, in fact, as you can see in this photograph, the two different planes with different kinds of stars on them. A fairly successful intelligence operation in that sense. So following his military intelligence work, Kieswalter, and this is as a footnote, would become one of CIA's most honored case officers. His affinity with the language and the Russian personality allowed him to effectively handle two of the most important Russian agents that the CIA ever ran, Peter Popov and Oleg Penkovsky. Both of these men are subjects of bestseller books. One is called Mole, The Story of Popov by William Hood, and the other about Penkovsky, The Spy Who Saved the World by Gerald Schatker. It was during the course of the decade 1946 to 1956, before the U-2 aircraft, before satellites, before we had instant worldwide communications, before we had even business or tourist travel by Westerners to the Soviet Union, that America found itself virtually blind to Soviet strategic plans and capabilities and intent. Economic information from the Soviet Union at the time was either inaccurate, misleading, or often it was intentionally both. The progress of Soviet science, likewise, was murky. All we could do was guess at the possible state of Soviet advanced technology. U.S. intelligence on Stalin's Russia was like Swiss cheese. It was simply mostly holes. So the CIA was created in 1947 in part to fill that information gap, as well as to contest the aggressive spread of Soviet communism. In 1947, as the CIA was being formed, a letter was sent from the Pentagon to the Alaska Command inquiring about the potential of obtaining intelligence on the Russian side of the Straits of Alaska from an Alaska operational base. Lawrence Kastner was suggested as the person to organize the effort. But unfortunately, his death in 1949 precluded any follow-up. That same year, a CIA officer named Rocky, not making that up, name was Rocky, was sent from Washington to survey Alaska for its operational potential. The idea was, can we run human agent operations on the Chukotsky Peninsula and Siberia? Now, we were unable to fly reconnaissance in the Soviet Union airspace at the time. We didn't have satellites, and we had virtually no information on Soviet readiness in Siberia. So Rocky wrote his report, concluding that there was great operational potential to address these questions from Alaska. He recommended immediately establishment of a base in Alaska, or in the territory. Typical, again, of Washington, CIA seniors were in no hurry to make a decision, so they kicked the can down the road. Rocky's recommendation was not really refused, it just was kind of ignored. The next year, some people who still thought it was a good idea sent another officer, Quentin Johnson, to Alaska. Quentin Johnson was there to determine if we could support, the CIA could support an infiltration operation with the Air Force into eastern Siberia. Johnson returned with the recommendation, probably not what his superiors or the Air Force wanted to hear, that it was just aerial photography of military targets, not agent infiltration, would be a better option. Johnson concluded that the risk of capture or death of an agent outweighed the likelihood of a successful mission. Now, Johnson's efforts would have ended the discussion of a CIA station in Alaska, except for three events and a fourth reality. The surprise test of the Soviet atomic bomb in August 1949 further exposed the weakness of our intelligence apparatus. Secondly, the eruption of the Korean War in June the following summer meant that in one sense the Cold War was at least partially hot. And third, the production or the announced production of the new Tupolev 95, the four-engine turboprop strategic bomber known as the Bear, became known to American planners. The fourth item, equally important, was that the Soviets had now launched an aggressive Arctic research program, putting manned research stations on floating on ice floes in the Arctic. The assumption was this was directly related to support of naval, Soviet naval operations. So now, with particularly with the Tu-95 and the Soviet atomic weapon, the issue became, can the Soviets deliver a nuclear bomb to the United States? The station, the CIA station, opened shortly thereafter, and two young officers were volunteered for an assignment. Their names were Art and John, both officers, now no longer young men, are still living. They were posted in Germany at the time, but when Art heard about the station, he immediately contacted his friend. He said, look, you know, we can hunt and fish all we want because there's nothing else to do up there. John said, yeah, I recall replying, look, you know, I've seen Europe. I've already seen the world. Let's go to Alaska. And so off they went to Alaska. Art handled the station's communications, and John had responsibility for establishing transportations and a logistics infrastructure. Now, from this base, CIA at the time envisioned operations into Siberia that would involve the establishment of clandestine information networks, developing a human spy base, asset base, surveying targets, and inducing Russian defections, and then managing their exfiltration. Some of these proposals were stunningly ambitious. For example, one project envisioned a 140-person Alaskan mission that would direct and support more than 2,000 agents operating on Soviet soil in Siberia. Another considered establishing a commercial facility unassociated with the United States government in Nome to train and debrief Eskimo agents dispatched into the peninsula. A third proposed constructing a large covert high-frequency broadcasting facility on the Aleutians to beam propaganda into Siberia. And a fourth involved the recruiting of several Alaskan bush pilots to overfly and photograph Soviet military facilities in eastern Siberia. The reasoning here, of course, is that a civilian plane in Siberia is not nearly as provocative as a military plane in Siberia. So over time, these initial expectations would be radically altered by the realities of distance, environment, costs, and most significantly, technology. The idea of 2,000 agents in Siberia was dropped as impractical because of the challenges of recruitment, the virtually non-existent communications infrastructure, and transportation uncertainties. The deep cover facility in Nome was declared economically unsound. The broadcast operation on the Aleutians was abandoned after propagation studies determined that coverage of the populated areas of the Soviet Union, even those into Siberia, would be better from Okinawa and Japan. Now, using bush pilots for aerial photography was predictable and was practical, and that was doable. But the risk of capture, combined with the limited range of the private aircraft, mitigated most of the intelligence utility. There was one daring CIA Navy operation during the Korean War period. It was described by retired senior CIA officer Pierre de Silva as the clandestine landing of a CIA-trained reconnaissance team on the Siberian coast that was intended to obtain information about a runway that was being constructed at Pravodinia Bay in the Soviet Far East. So four hardy Russian-speaking Slavic agents were recruited. Submarine was dispatched from Hawaii to launch the team on a rubber boat near the target coast. And upon landing, the team would walk to the vicinity of the airport, observe and photograph, retrace their steps, and recover the boat and reboard the sub. The intelligence question, and it was an important intelligence question at the time was whether the runway that was being constructed had the length and the strength to support the weight of a Tu-95 bomber carrying an atomic weapon. So DeSilva claimed that the operation went well, that the team was launched as expected, that it went to the target area, did its reconnaissance, and safely returned to the mother ship. The only problem was the fighting of boredom in the weeks that remained as the submarine continued its normal patrol and returned to Hawaii. In other words, in the words of at least one of our presidents, mission accomplished. Now, that account is disputed by another CIA officer whose information I tend to think has some credibility because he was on the sub. Now, in his telling, the trip was anything but harmonious. The Slavic team immediately got into personality conflicts. Their personalities clashed, and as they reached the time of launch time, it was clear that their fear factor had increased exponentially. But nevertheless, they launched as planned, and things seemed to be going pretty well until about 2 o'clock the next morning, when the submarine's radar detected an unidentified object moving on the ocean surface toward the sub. Now, the rubber boat wasn't scheduled to get back for another 36 hours, so understandably there was great concern on the submarine. The sailors were ordered to station. Armed sailors were put on the deck of the sub, and it surfaced to see what was going on. And in fact, they identified the rubber boat with the infiltrators was drifting back toward them. In other words, the infiltrators never made it to their target or mission aborted. Now, you can take your choice as to which of these endings you prefer, but the important element is that the operation represented the kind of planning, risk, and coordination that U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA, and the military agencies considered necessary for national security in those early days of the Cold War. Now, back at the newly established station, John Peck had known to many in the Alaskan aviation community, was one of the Alaskan bush pilots that made his services available to the station. On a Memorial Day weekend, when there was nothing of importance occurring, Art and John went fishing in the Kenai Peninsula. They had a wooden boat, and they were thinking far more about landing trophies than about national security. Their dreams were shattered by the sight of Peck's small plane in a steep dive headed directly toward them. At seemingly the last instant, John recalls, Peck banked the plane, and from the passenger side, the CIA station chief was recognized, and he dropped into the river bank an object that looked like a bomb by the craft, just missing that wooden craft by a couple of feet. The dropped item was a can of oil. Large can of oil with a note around it encased in plastic, and it instructed Art to hike back to the road area where Peck could land the plane, pick him up, because the station had received a flash message from Washington. A flash message in CIA terminology requires immediate action by the receiving unit. So, Memorial Day fishing weekend interrupted. Art goes back to the station, and John is left up the river with that wooden craft. John said, John said that, you know, the rest of the day, he had two thoughts in mind as he was taking this boat back down to their pickup in the trailer. One was, how in the world am I going to load this thing by myself and get home? But secondly, he said, you know, if that oil can had hit the boat rather than landing in the river, we would have had a hole, a 2-foot hole in the bottom of this wooden boat, and yeah, then where would we have been? Well, it's the accidents of nature are, I suppose, probably the currency of doing operations in one sense. In any event, the flash message was for the commanding general at Fort Richardson, and again, the story is told to illustrate the dramatic measures that the CIA was taking at the time to ensure that relationship and coordination of support to the Alaskan Military Command. Back in Washington, CIA managers continued to debate the viability of the Alaskan outpost. The intensity of the debate over the whether or not Alaska CIA merited a station in Alaska caused the chief of the Soviet Russia division at CIA to make a personal trip to the station in the mid-1950s. What he observed did not surprise either Art or John. His report concluded, quote, if anyone in Washington thinks there's an easy way to penetrate the Siberian Peninsula, they will have to come out and do it themselves. Anyone who has talked about more active agent operations in this area has no idea of the actual local conditions, unquote. While this report coming from a senior officer had some impact, however, it's Washington politics that we're talking about here, not necessarily logic. And the Alaska Command itself had come to value this direct link that it had to CIA headquarters without having to go through the Pentagon, right? Pretty interesting. That pressure from the Alaska Command, coupled with the station's contribution to the command's regular unconventional warfare planning documents and a national security assessment that President Eisenhower had ordered, which advocated the development of equipment and clandestine operations in the polar ice regions, meant that CIA really couldn't just close the station. So it would remain open, but the staff was reduced from 4 people to 2. The CIA really disengaged from attempting to mount further agent operations into Siberia, but the Navy interest was very strong in the Soviet Arctic. As I mentioned, in the 1950s, the Soviets were constructing a series of research stations on ice floes that were believed to be supporting their naval activity. The stations were temporary because at some stage the ice would crack and reform, and the flows would become unsafe for resupply of these stations. So an unexpected opportunity arose when nearly 1,000 miles from Barrow, a Soviet research station known as NP-8 was abandoned. The CIA and the Navy then considered an operation to insert a team on the floe that would collect and assess any equipment, notes, or other information that might have been left behind. Let's have the next slide in case. So on this slide, you can roughly see where Anchorage is, where the NP-8 flow target research station was, and where the operation had to be launched from Barrow. Now, there were 3 huge challenges to this operation. First, just locating the always moving ice flow, somewhere 800 or 1,000 miles out of Barrow or out of Thule, which was the other possible location for the operation, it had to be located before an operation could be launched. Secondly, getting a team onto the ice floe with no usable runway presented something of a problem. We have parachutes, right? And third, extracting the people off the floe when you don't have helicopters who can reach it, or planes that can land on it, or ships that can reach it. So considerable planning debate followed. The two-man team was put together. It had to be confident that they could make a parachute landing without broken bones and other problems. It would be risky, but it would not be as risky as the Fulton Skyhook extraction idea. The Fulton Skyhook was first developed by OSS, the predecessor to CIA, in World War II. In this short clip, you will see first a practice pickup by the Fulton Skyhook of an inanimate object, and then a live object, and finally some fool actually volunteered. To use it in real human testing. It is unlikely he signed any waivers that he would have had to do today. Now, the CIA had, over the years, adapted this for lifting agents or officers out of jungle clearings where helicopters couldn't land. But the idea of using the Fulton Skyhook in the conditions of the Arctic, really the rapidly changing weather conditions of the Arctic, was quite an adventure. On May 28, 1962, two officers, Leonard Leshack and James Smith, made the 800-mile flight from Barrow to NP-8. In contrast to the earlier submarine effort in the Siberian airfield, this team did not get cold feet. They jumped onto the floe and, as planned, over the next 2 days, surveyed the abandoned Soviet station, collected bits of information, and to the degree possible, enjoyed their adventure. If there were any apprehensions, it was with the Skyhook. And those apprehensions were not confined to just the guys on the ground. It was also apprehensive of the gentlemen who were the pilots who are flying the airplane. And it was justified. The apprehension was fully justified. On the scheduled day of the pickup, the aircraft flew from Barrow to the target area and couldn't find the ice floe. On day two, the airplane flew from Barrow to the region and could not find the ice floe. On the third day, now there's no radio communication between these folks at the time. Remember that. Leshack says, well, you know, we enjoyed our sea rations. And I trust that they did, because there was no telling how long they were going to be eating them. On the third day, and with the pilot reporting that he was probably within 30 minutes of running out of fuel and having to return, the ice floe was finally located. That was the good news. The bad news was that the ceiling was 500 feet and the visibility was under a mile, and the weather conditions were deteriorating. We're talking about 5:30 in the afternoon. Wind was increasing. The blowing snow was threatening to be to whiteout conditions. And Smith, who was on the ice, said, you know, even I was beginning to get a bit sweaty. In the plane, one of the pilots said he recalled thinking, after months of practice, we're making our first ever live pickup in conditions that we have never experienced, never practiced in, or even imagined. So it took three passes. Over the next hour, the Skyhook first extracted some equipment, then Leshack, and then Smith. None of the extractions were routine, although all were difficult, and particularly with the two men, particularly dangerous. But the plane landed with the mission accomplished in Barrow at 045 hours on June 3rd, 1962. Now, with the benefit of history, I can conclude that the nature and scope of CIA military operations in Alaska were affected more by post-war American technology than by any other factor. By the mid-1950s, the American aircraft industry had created the high-altitude platforms for a new generation of photographic spies. We were producing cameras that could photograph from angles and distances impossible for humans. In July 4, 1956, and for the following 4 years, 24 U-2 flights photographed Soviet airfields and missile sites. By 1961, our Corona satellite program was operational. The intelligence in Siberia that we had once considered risking lives to obtain had become the stuff of film, of images, of photo interpreters, and signals analysis. We were acquiring electronics for communications and signal intercept systems that eavesdropped on private conversations with no human present. Our national laboratories were now developing chemical and radioactivity sensors that were capable of detecting and monitoring activities that were otherwise invisible to the eye and silent to the ear. For U.S. intelligence, virtually all of these systems would first be deployed against the Soviet target. That meant the technology had to survive and operate in the harshest environments. For CIA, Alaska's beautifully frigid and volatile weather offered an ideal testbed for systems before deployment to the Arctic. In the late 1950s, CIA technical officers tested several prototype systems at Elmendorf and Shemya that would ultimately be included as part of several of the Cobra series of collections platforms. In 1959, the integrated circuit was invented, and that subsequently enabled the development of ground and mobile sensors for clandestine collection of data that had not been visible to overhead photography. We now see that over those first 20 years of the Cold War, technical collection against the Soviet strategic capability eroded the need for the type of human agent operations once envisioned for the Alaska Station. So while the Cold War continued, the Alaska Station closed, but CIA's interest in the state did not. When the Soviets announced plans for their Trans-Siberian pipeline in the early 1980s, CIA economic analysts needed to understand the cost, risk, processes, technologies needed for such a massive undertaking. Next slide, please. The only comparable engineering project was the Alyeska pipeline that had been operating then for 5 years. So at that time, I was stationed in Seattle and I accompanied the head of our Office of Economic Analysis for extensive discussions with the pipeline folks, with the facilities at Prudhoe Bay and the Valdez Terminal. Now, information alone is not intelligence. Good intelligence is accurate information plus the objective analysis. Knowledge of the Alaska pipeline experience gave our economic analysts the hard data to assess how the Soviets would likely proceed with their project. It was actually one of the important and significant intelligence assessments that proved to be quite accurate during the 1980s. Now, about the same time, the United States government became suspicious of Soviet construction materials going into the new embassy in Moscow. The concrete structural beams that were being made by the Soviet companies and installed by the Russian construction crews were riddled with stuff that we didn't understand, we suspected. So working with State Department security, the CIA developed a special topographic system to inspect concrete beams. New inspection technology required testing and verification before being deployed in what was a very sensitive issue between the two countries. So a technical team, quiet technical team, quietly brought the tomographic system to Fairbanks. I had the opportunity to accompany them on one winter in 1984. The idea was to evaluate the cold weather performance of this new system. So using a variety of the Fairbanks buildings as targets, and we did coordinate with the FBI in this instance. The equipment provided proved reliable, although to my knowledge no actual bugs were found in any of the Fairbanks structures. When we deployed it to Moscow, we found hundreds of embedded microphones and antennas in the embassy's structure. There was no way to neutralize or remove them, so the United States decided to demolish and replace the vulnerable floors of the embassy. We punished the bad behavior by the Soviets by refusing to allow them to occupy their newly completed chancery in Washington for 9 years. So that was a real hardship, I'm sure, on those diplomats. But finally, we assured ourselves that the Moscow embassy was clean. So in the years of CIA's Alaska station, one reflects on the transformative decades of espionage history. The traditional agent spy, human agent spy, now began sharing the stage, or perhaps I should say the dark alleys, with technology that in many instances performed tasks that were impossible for spies. That technology revolution continues. So we have entered, in terms of the digital world, a new generation of spy gadgets and spy capabilities. I think in closing, there's a false argument that sometimes arises over whether American intelligence relies too much on technology at the expense of the traditional spy. Now, I contend that people and technology are not competitive in the espionage game. They are complementary. Spies can do some things very well. They can do many things better when they're aided by technology. Technical systems, whether it's covert computer implants or satellite tracking or communications intercepts or in-placed sensors, can sometimes function best when not being touched by human hands, but often they cannot get to where they need to work without the human involvement. So it still takes a human spy to know the specific intent and timing of the plans of a terrorist. It still requires human analytical judgment to discern the likely impact of economic sanctions on an adversary. It still requires innovative scientists and engineers to apply their brilliance to adapt new technology to espionage uses. Human spies will, as in the past, still be required for some sensitive and dangerous missions that may or may not involve technology. Sending spies on such missions requires sound human judgment as to decide which and when what combinations of people and technical systems can most effectively be used. So as a retired CIA officer, I want to express my appreciation to the people and institutions of Alaska for your contributions to the CIA's needs for information, for support, for logistics, for analysis, and for testing. Some of these activities I have mentioned today, there are far more that remain properly classified. I'm reminded that in January 1961, at the height of the Cold War, President Kennedy challenged every American to ask the question, "What can I do for my country?" To that question, and from across this state, Alaskans responded to Americans' intelligence needs affirmatively, quietly, and proudly. I'm confident that that spirit continues in Alaska. In fact, I think it is in your DNA. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Bob Wallace, who's giving a talk on spies who went into the cold. This talk was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded on Friday, September 5th at the Hotel Captain Cook. From here, the talk moves into a question and answer period with the audience.
Hi, Mr. Wallace.
Yes.
So I've spoken to a fellow Cold Warrior CIA case officer before, and one of the things that he kind of bemoaned in about the modern state of affairs in CIA today is the militarization of the CIA. And I refer to the fact that in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Iraq, we're seeing a lot of CIA operatives, some case officers, maybe some people from the SID, relying heavily on drones, and their mission has kind of changed from intelligence gathering to acting on that intelligence. And he said that this has actually damaged our intelligence collection efforts because a lot of the people that normally would be useful assets to recruit or to get information from have been turned off by the fact that we've been acting on this intelligence fairly rapidly with lethal results. And I know that you were kind of around at the end of your career for the beginning of this kind of drone renaissance. So maybe you could share some of your thoughts on that, please.
As a historian, I think there will be a story written about American intelligence as a 2001 watershed. The organization, CIA's mission, was enhanced substantially by presidential and congressional direction after 2001 to become heavily involved in the quasi-combat or the direct combat role against certain of the terrorist targets. That became a shared responsibility with the military. We had officers from my unit, the Office of Technical Service, in late 2001, joined up with Special Forces officers from the military to conduct operations in the Kandahar area. And this kind of cooperation and sharing of intelligence and military operations has grown in the decades since. This debate rages within CIA. Just a specific example, speaking from now my personal background, when one joins an organization, frequently one's future thinking about how activities are done are determined by your experiences of your first couple of assignments, your first assignment or two. So if your first assignment or your first and second assignment are in war zones where you are involved in hostile actions more than or at least in parallel to whatever you're doing on the intelligence collection side, you know, that becomes a factor in your future thinking. So I think the concern about what is the impact of CIA's role in the military-like actions over the past 10 years is going to be a topic that future CIA leaders will need to work on.
Well, thank you. It was very interesting, especially for me. I like such stories. But I have three quick questions.
All right. Now, I promise not to torture you.
Three very quick. From my understanding, Oleg Penkovsky was not CIA, but British spy and ran by the person Greenwell. The second question about the American embassy, from my understanding, they was discovered all these microphones when at the time of the short honeymoon between CIA and KGB, the KGB director provides CIA with all maps of all these listening devices. So, or you found them before. And the third question is simple curiosity. What interesting was found on the MP8 station?
First question, Penkovsky. if you have an intelligence success, you certainly do not want to share the credit with anyone else. In fact, yes, Penkovsky was jointly run with the British. George Kiesewalter from the American side was the principal case officer that handled the most of the debriefings, the face-to-face debriefings with Penkovsky on our side. The second question was, yes, I believe we did know that there was bad stuff in that embassy. And I suppose, was that some of your friends that were putting that in at the time? the third question, what was found on NP8? I think probably the most useful material that was found on NP8 was some of the types of technology that the Russian scientists had left behind, from the equipment they'd left behind, the kind of technologies they were using to make their ice measurements and the various research that they were doing.
Did you know if there were any women who were in active Alaskan intelligence?
None that I know on our side. No, I'm making a joke of that. Yes, there were women officers from our office that worked in Alaska during and after the time that I did. Yes.
Hi. So you spoke about how Soviet science in the Arctic was sort of, or could have been, a cover for intelligence gathering activities on their part. With our Arctic research, like the Arctic Research Laboratory at Barrow, did they have any role in intelligence or espionage work that you know of?
I want to make clear the distinction. I'm not saying that the Soviet Arctic research was done as a cover. I'm saying it was done, and so it was supportive of their naval interests. The research that our side did in the Arctic, my assumption would be that the U.S. Navy would have been quite interested in that as well, yes.
Bob, thank you. What can you tell us about Russian spying in Alaska and their own assessment of our capabilities here in terms of our air bases, our missile radars, that sort of thing?
This is a question I particularly enjoy answering, because this distinction between CIA responsibilities and FBI responsibilities is very clear, and at least during my tenure was well honored. So any counterintelligence issue relative to Alaska or any other place in the United States, that was jealously guarded by the FBI, and properly so. From the standpoint of the CIA, we were very happy to let the CIA handle that. In terms of offensive operations, certainly both the FBI and the CIA were interested in assessing Soviet officials, and particularly Soviet intelligence officials, who might be recruitable. And those programs were run jointly in specific areas around the United States. If a Soviet intelligence officer was recruited as a spy, that individual would be handled in the United States by the FBI, and when they then were reposted someplace else in the world or were recalled to Moscow, the CIA would pick up responsibility for handling the agent.
My question involves defectors through the Berlin situation from the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you have any information or even an educated guess as to how many or what percentage of those that succeeded opposed to those who did not succeed when they attempted to defect through Berlin?
That would be a question to which I don't have any definitive information. Some certainly did. There were plenty of reports of those who were captured or killed in terms of their attempting to escape. If one has a chance to go to the museum in Berlin, there's just some remarkable, I'll put the word concealment devices in quotes, but concealments that people use to try to escape through Berlin during the 1960s. These were at times desperate people who were willing to put their lives on the line for the taste of freedom.
One audience member says with the CIA's help, he was able to aid one or two people out of Berlin. For that help, he says, thank you.
I thank you very much. This is the third compliment CIA has received this year, I believe.
I just had a quick comment about the 9-month wait for the Russians to occupy their embassy. You have to mention, we did give them the highest ground in Washington, D.C. for their satellite reception. They got the choice place. You know this, of course, in Washington, D.C. I don't know how that came about, but perhaps they had an embassy there before. But they're right near the National Cathedral, and they have tremendous location. Whereas I don't think our location in Moscow is quite as good.
If I said 9 months, I apologize. It was 9 years that we really punished them. We didn't just, really, really. Yes, in fact, an area of Washington known as Mount Alta. Washington, if you haven't been there, doesn't have any mountains or really big hills, but one of the larger ones is Mount Alto. And for whatever reason, we're pretty sure why the Soviets wanted to build on that site, why the United States government agreed to that, is a story that I do not know.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with ex-CIA officer Bob Wallace. Wallace's talk, Spies Who Went Into the Cold, was the keynote presentation at the 2014 Alaska Cold War Conference. This talk was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded at noon on Friday, September 5th, at the Hotel Captain Cook. For more information about Alaska's significance during the Cold War, check out our website for more coverage at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. We want to give a special thanks to APRN's Josh Edge for his stellar field recording skills. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.